This morning, we welcome our own Allie Becker as speaker. Allie has never known what she wanted to be when she grew up, because so many things sound like fun. So why not try them all? She has worn many hats in her day, including pizza maker, bread baker, nanny, naturalist, grant writer, forestry technician, and cartographer. She currently stays at home with her two daughters, which is the best hat yet. Allie's spiritual life is equally chaotic and undecided. Raised in a home where religion and spirituality weren't things anybody had any interest in discussing, she learned most of what she knows from books while competing as a Lincoln-Douglas debater in high school. Debating both sides of moral and ethical issues for many years trained her to be a good UU. None of the religious and philosophical leaders or texts ever convinced her that they had found the way. There is so much to see and experience in this world, it would be impossible to do and know it all. So she plans on wearing as many hats, asking as many questions, and experiencing as many things as possible. Allie is the current chair of UUFM, which is great, because it gives her something to focus on that doesn't include popsicles, glitter, and discussions on why squirts are the best choice for the playground. This is a really good intro. She is currently taking a class through the UU Institute called Organizing on the Side of Love, which inspired this talk. Let's welcome Allie.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Make some noise, sorry. I haven't done anything like this in a really long time, so I'm probably a little rusty, but here we go. My inspiration for this talk, like Frank said, comes from the class that I'm taking through the UU Institute with the same name. And my original plan was to talk about all the things that I learned in the class, but I hadn't really started the class yet, and I didn't really know exactly how that would go, and come to find out that probably would have been really boring, because it's pretty technical. So I'm shifting gears a little bit, but I'm going to talk about organizing and activism, its place in the UU tradition, and how we can all come to be a little bit more engaged in action. I was also really inspired by attending the Poetry Slam this week, because like I said, it's very moving, and the stage is considered a safe place where people can get up and they can talk about their experiences in the world, especially as it relates to social injustices. And I heard it referred to as activism while I was there by some of the poets, and I think that in a way that it is, so I'll talk about what I learned there a little bit too. So about a year and a half ago, I guess, this congregation voted that they wanted to focus their social justice efforts on environmentalism. So I will frame a lot of the examples in that context as I go through the talk, and also I'll frame them in a personal one, because I think a lot of this is very personal, and it should be personal when you're choosing how you want to participate in social justice in the world. Action originates with a feeling that can't be quelled, and a feeling that things aren't right, and an inability to ignore that feeling within yourself. And there are two things that I'm going to be talking about today when it comes to action. One is activism, and the second is community organizing. So like any good former debater would, I'm going to define those terms before we move forward. We'll start with activism. Oxford Dictionaries defines activism as the policy or action of using vigorous campaigning to bring about political or social change. And the same dictionary defines community organizing as the coordination of cooperative efforts and campaigning carried out by local residents to promote the interests of their community. So the biggest difference between the two terms really is that activism can be done alone. And there are a lot of people in the world that do a lot of really great things solo. But community organizing requires bringing people together and to make a change. And the most important thing about community organizing, I think, is that it oftentimes bridges the gap between people who don't have a voice in making change with those that do. So, for instance, it allows people in a low-income neighborhood that are having a lot of trouble with potholes in their streets reach the right people to get those things fixed. It allows factory workers to speak out about their jobs being shipped overseas, whereas maybe as individuals they wouldn't have the power in a single voice to express or make change in that area. So that's where the power comes from. It comes from bringing people together to make a change where you maybe couldn't do it alone. And it can be small or big, local or regional, national or international. And so you'll see change happening in your neighborhood, perhaps. Sockham being here last week talking about how, I'm going to forget the terms now, but how our local representatives are elected at large, which means they don't necessarily have to live in the neighborhood that they represent. And so he said the mayor and all of our local representatives live within like 2 miles of each other in a wealthy Murfreesboro neighborhood. So like, for instance, the neighborhood that Blake and I live in, whoever's representing us doesn't actually live there. That would be a change that is made locally and in the small. And then you'll see it internationally in a lot of different examples. So community organizing has also become somewhat synonymous with nonviolent revolt. And you see a lot of that in the news these days. And it has risen in popularity as an organizing tactic, not because everyone in community organizing is against the use of force. They're not. A lot of people don't know that Martin Luther King actually applied for a concealed carry permit at a certain point in his life because he was receiving so many personal threats on his family, and he wanted to protect his family. He himself wasn't necessarily individually against the use of force in the beginning, but he became to be that way over the course of his life and through his work, because community organizing is a tactic that works, and it works oftentimes better than the use of force when trying to make change. And so that's a beautiful thing and a powerful thing, because it means that you can use reason with a lot of people, not everybody, obviously, but you can use reason with a lot of people to convince them to use this nonviolent tactic to make change. So if you're interested in learning more about that, a lot of the things that I'm going to brush on are like whole talks in and of themselves. We could go on for a long time, but this book right here is a really good place to start. It's called This Is an Uprising, and it's the history of nonviolent revolt. It's actually the companion text to the class that I'm taking, and it has a lot of really good information in it. But just a brief history of it. Nonviolent revolt dates back to 391 BC, which a lot of people don't realize has been used forever, when the Mohist philosophical school disapproved of war and began using fortifications to protect themselves and separate themselves from the warring factions around them. It became a better known tactic during the civil disobedience movement in India in the 1930s, which was led by Mahatma Gandhi, rejecting the British imposed taxes, boycotting British manufactured products, and mass strikes, including the famous Salt March. Most famous acts of nonviolent resistance in the U.S., or many, I'm sorry, are women's suffrage, the Cherokee removal, the civil rights movement is probably the most famous, the Chicano movement, anti-war protests during the Vietnam War, the Committee of Nonviolent Action, which was against the U.S. arsenal of nuclear weapons, draft resistance, the Los Angeles Black Cat Revolt, which was revolting against the harassment of the LGBT community, Occupy Wall Street more recently, and many, many more. That's just a drop in the bucket. It's happening all of the time. And Unitarian Universalism has been a part of that community organizing and nonviolent revolt from the beginning. It's a long legacy. I'll give a couple examples. Our own Olympia Brown, who was the first woman to graduate from a regularly established theological school and ordained as a Universalist minister, took an active role in the women's suffrage movement and was one of the first original suffragists who lived to vote in the 1920s presidential election. And she led the Wisconsin Suffrage Association for many years and served as vice president of the National Women's Suffrage Association. And Unitarian Lydia Marie Child was known for her activism when it came to Native American rights, as well as abolitionism and women's rights. She wrote a book called, I'm going to mispronounce this probably, Hobomuck, A Tale of Early Times, and she wrote it under a pseudonym. I think her pseudonym was an American, I'm pretty sure. It's very general. But, I mean, she was a woman in the 1800s, so. And it was about interracial marriage between a white woman and a Native American man, which was very scandalous. And she also wrote many pamphlets on Native American rights, the most famous being An Appeal for the Indians, which contributed to the founding of the U.S. Board of Indian Commissioners and the peace policy under Ulysses S. Grant. And these are just a couple of examples, and the list goes on into modern day, and we could probably fill at least one talk and probably two or three with this long legacy within a Unitarian University church. And in my opinion, and probably most people's here, it's a legacy to be very, very proud of. UUs are active in many social justice issues today. As most of you will know, we follow a deeds, not creeds legacy. And the justice efforts extend from economic justice to environmental justice, immigrant justice, LGBTQ, racial and reproductive justice, and voting rights. The Standing on the Side of Love campaign, which is the people teaching the course that I'm taking are from that organization, is sponsored by the UUA, and it is an interfaith public advocacy campaign promoting respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person or being. And they pursue social change through nonviolent methods such as advocacy, public witness, and speaking out in solidarity with those whose lives are publicly demeaned. They have most recently been very active in the Black Lives Matter movement, and at the General Assembly this year, that was what they focused on, as well as the fight for LGBTQ civil rights. They're very active in that. And there is even a UU College of Social Justice that hosts programs for many different demographics, from high school students to individuals wanting to participate. And these programs are experiential and meant to help participants better understand the dynamics of race, class, power, and privilege, both in their own lives and the lives of the people that they visit. So they take trips into communities and work with these communities, as well as take classes and become educated on issues. Each program explores the history, context, and current struggles of the people and area being visited. And I'm just going to read the Standing on the Side of Love theory of change real quick for you guys so you kind of understand how they believe they're going to make change. Every social movement, if it's going to make any difference at all, generally has a theory of change. It's basically like their mission statement or how they think that they're going to do that. And so the vision of the Standing on the Side of Love campaign is that people's lives are more just and more equitable because we raise our voices collectively. We are a growing network of justice leaders, Unitarian Universalist, multi-faith, and spiritual, engaged in harnessing the power of love to stop oppression. The Standing on the Side of Love campaign of the Unitarian Universalist Association encourages and supports UUs and partners to use creative, accountable, and entrepreneurial approaches to justice-making efforts. And then they have three different ways of how we do it. We use our hearts and minds to connect with persons directly impacted by the issues, engaged in the work, and sharing the personal stories. And we provide a spiritual place where people feel a sense of inclusion. We shift culture by prioritizing and reaching of new and different people. Intentional about sources we lift up that closely align with UU values that also push internal politics. We provide UUs with resources to deepen knowledge of pressing social issues. And then we influence policy. We are at the foreground of shifting paradigms with interfaith partners, and we are a visible presence in public discourse while advocating UU values, rallies, lobbying, call days, actions, et cetera, et cetera. So why is this important? Why do we engage in activism or organizing around a specific issue, and how do we engage? For me, the how is always the trickiest part. For most everyone, the reasons have to be personal. This type of work takes courage and commitment and oftentimes does not come with any sort of paycheck. It also doesn't always produce instant results, and this can be the most frustrating part. Sometimes success doesn't look or feel like success in the moment, and sometimes you don't succeed at all in your initial tries. And it requires a great deal of flexibility within a movement as well, and taking advantage of opportunities, being able to see a door open and walk through it in that moment. And it's like I said in the beginning, it has to be a feeling you can't ignore, and it has to be an injustice you feel personally tied to if you're going to make a long-term commitment to it. And sometimes you are tied very intimately to an issue. It's just not as obvious as you might think. In the words of activist Barbara Brenner, who I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, sooner or later, all issues of social justice are connected. and we as individuals can advance the arc of history towards justice by volunteering. The world changes because we work for change. According to the UUA Congregational Study and Action Issues page, we are stronger together. Our combined efforts to make the world more fair and humane can accomplish more than any one of us working alone. As Unitarian Universalists, we set priorities for our social justice efforts by investing in key issues that exemplify our commitments to justice, equity, and compassion. I'll speak about environmentalism for just a minute, since that's what we focus our efforts on primarily here. And I'll just give you a few reasons why environmental issues are important to me, just to give an example of how sometimes you're connected to an issue, it just might not seem that obvious. The first one's very obvious. I really, really love to be out in the wilderness. And I'm not just talking about being outside and going for hikes. I really love to be in wild spaces, like out where you feel like a bear could like really be a bear without having to worry about things like looking out for cars or what trash is safe to eat. Like, no adaptive skills are necessary. And I really, really want to see those spaces preserved. That's very important to me. That's an obvious way how I'm connected to it. Secondly, I'm a mother. And the fact that my children might not have clean drinking water or clean air or non-GMO food to eat when they become adults is very concerning to me. And I would like to try and live, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the seven generation theory. It was a Native American theory. You see it printed on a lot of paper products now. It's a brand. But it's the idea that you live in the moment as if the environment will be the same seven generations from now. So you want to preserve what we have now for seven generations in the future, and that's how you try to live. And it's a Native American philosophy that some people hold dear. And as a mother, that's important to me. Thirdly, I'm a cancer patient. One of no evidence of disease, though. But not only that, I'm a cancer patient with no family history of disease and no genetic markers that indicate I might be at higher risk of getting cancer. And then, so this woman here, Barbara Brenner, who I quoted just a minute ago, was a breast cancer patient as well and a lifelong activist. She was an activist before she became a breast cancer patient. She passed away in 2014, not of breast cancer, but of ALS. And spent a good portion of her life advocating for health justice, especially for women who were not able to get the treatment they needed for the things that they had. So she started working for a group called the Breast Cancer Action when it was in its infancy, when she first became diagnosed, and she focused her work primarily on environmental factors that caused the disease and treatment options. And according to the Breast Cancer Action's website, over half of the women diagnosed with breast cancer in the United States have no known risk factors, with family history accounting for only around 10% of breast cancer diagnoses. A large and growing body of research indicates that toxic chemicals may increase our risk of developing the disease. In 2010, the President's Cancer Panel reported that the true burden of environmentally induced cancer has been grossly underestimated. And the American people, even before they are born, are bombarded continually with myriad combinations of these dangerous exposures. So, did something in the environment cause my disease? Maybe so. That I will never know for certain. I mean, likely, but I'll never know for certain. So if I could stop one other person from getting sick by advocating for a healthier environment, it would be worth it to me. And maybe you identify with one of these reasons that I've mentioned. And maybe not. There are many, many more. Maybe you hunt or fish and are concerned about the pollutants the wildlife are being exposed to or the loss of hunting land. Maybe you are a pacifist and are concerned about the ever more common resource wars that are likely to increase as we see results of global warming start to affect our ability to grow food and access clean drinking water. These things are already starting to happen. And maybe there is another reason. All over the country, children of color suffer from higher rates of asthma because schools with higher percentages of children of color are more often located near sources of air pollution. Black lives matter. Low-income families, mostly black families, live near the Defense Depot in Memphis, where toxic chemicals have been contaminating the soil, water, and air. It was placed on the Superfund National Priority List, but little has been done to clean it up, and the people living in those communities suffer from health effects, including cancer. Low-income families deserve clean living conditions. Also, Black Lives Matter. That one applies there, too. There are, you know, thousands of examples all over this community, all over the country, all over the world, that can connect you to an environmental issue in some way. The point is, social justice issues affect all of us. And in some way or another, we are all affected by the destruction of the earth. We are all affected by the abuses against people of color and the LGBTQ community. We are all affected by economic injustices. And all of these issues are important, and all of these issues are connected. Now, what are we supposed to do about it? I have spent a lot of time being overwhelmed by the largeness of social injustices in the world. Especially in the digital age, it is so easy to be overburdened by bad news. It literally feels impossible to change anything, and I feel that a lot. What am I going to do that is going to make any difference in this mess? Is it too late? Does it even matter? But the truth is, real activism doesn't take place in the grand stage. It takes place here. It takes place here, and it takes place right out there. Lots of visual aids. Journalist Courtney Martin has written this really lovely book called Do It Anyway. I like it a lot. And if you read the On Being blog, Krista Tippett's show on NPR, she has a blog also that's pretty amazing if you don't read it. You'll be familiar with her work. She does a lot of work with Parker Palmer as well, who contributes to that blog. Anyway, she's a Gen Xer, just like me, and she makes a lot of good points about why people, especially from my generation, feel like we're losing the social justice battle. She labels us the Save the World generation, and she's really right. And she doesn't mean that we're going to save the world, because we're likely not going to save the world. She means that we were raised to believe that we can and should save the world. And I remember this so clearly growing up. It was embedded in our cartoons, our church camps, and even our MTV. It was everywhere. We had Sally Struthers asking us to save the children in Africa with our donations, and so on and so on. I remember singing We Are the World at school assemblies and really feeling like we were going to make a change. It was really literally everywhere. But it's such a broad and esoteric idea. Like, just go out and save the world. Just do it. No problem. So many of us realized at some point, whether in high school or college or beyond, that we weren't superheroes, and we felt really, really overwhelmed by the enormity of this idea, and a lot of us just kind of gave up. Courtney sums up what real activism is in this book while talking about the election of former community organizer Barack Obama, who we all know. His election is a blessing and a curse. On one hand, his election has made a lot of young people believe in the political process again, reflect on their own civic duty, and learn more about community organizing. On the other hand, all the hype that surrounded his candidacy has revived one of the more dangerous delusions, that saving the world is about heroics. In fact, the world will not be saved. The world will be changed. It looks more like your mom, her palm on your fevered forehead, her handwritten schedule for sharing childcare with neighbors, and her letter to the editor of the local newspaper, than it does your president. Activism is a daily, even hourly, experiment in dedication, moral courage, and resilience. She later gives the small example that it is like walking a few extra blocks to buy a burrito from a local farmer's market at lunch instead of buying from a national chain that's right across the street. And I know that I am capable of that kind of commitment and that kind of change, and I think we all are. A couple of lessons I learned this week at the National Poetry Slam seemed important to mention. The first is that we have to be careful not to just speak out inside of an echo chamber. It's lovely to be in a room full of people who agree with most of everything that you're saying, it really is, but that doesn't bring about change, and preaching to the choir doesn't equal activism. And so whereas I heard it spoken that slam poetry is activism at the competition, I think that they speak about issues of activism, but I definitely think that those rooms are echo chambers. And so if they were to take that to places where they were speaking to people who didn't agree with what they were already saying, I think that they could be a very powerful force. The second lesson, which was an eye-opener to me, And it's not something that I do often, but it's certainly something that I have done and have been guilty of in the past, is that some social media activism can be considered appropriating grief. And this was a very powerful poem to me. There was a girl who had lost her brother in the nightclub shooting in Orlando, and she performed a poem about that. And her words were, "You are not Orlando." And she felt robbed by the shallow appropriation of the real grief she was feeling over the loss of a loved one. And this made me think a little deeper about social media activism or solidarity. And it's a sticky wicket, and I don't know the right answer, and I will, but I'm not sure that these types of expressions of solidarity are appropriate or even effective. I think it takes more to really make a change, and I'll let you know when I have it figured out, so we'll talk again at like half past never, because I'm sure I will not ever have the right answer about a lot of this stuff. And something that I forgot to put in here, though, the most important thing probably, is that we can't let the things that we don't know deter us from not trying. And one thing that I've learned in this class and from my sister who works in social justice, she's a diversity director for the Girl Scouts in a very white community, is that if you are making an effort, a genuine effort, and someone, a person of color or someone who experiences oppression, critiques what you're doing, it's out of respect. If they stop critiquing you, that's when you should be worried. And so if you are making a genuine effort and you are out there trying and someone comes up to you and says, hey, what you're doing isn't appropriate, or maybe you should try doing it a different way, it's because they appreciate what you're doing and they're trying to help you do it right. And so don't take it personally, because it's not about you and it shouldn't be about you. It's about making the change. So I make a lot of mistakes all the time and I feel embarrassed about things that I've done, but I need to remind myself every day that it doesn't mean that I shouldn't keep trying. And so it may still feel overwhelming to figure out what to do. We're lucky here at UUFM because we have a built-in way to contribute. We have a social justice committee that organizes give away the baskets, letter writing campaigns, drives where we collect items for organizations, and other events. And for many, this will be, and it is, enough to participate in these things. But if it's not, I encourage you to volunteer for the Social Justice Committee next time around. Or make suggestions of things that we could do in the community at any time, because we're always looking for good ideas of ways to contribute. There are also many organizations to involve yourself with in our community. SOCM was here last week, and they are a great one. Their mission is to organize the community around certain issues in Middle Tennessee and statewide. There is also the Stones River Watershed Association, Friends of the Greenway, WREN, which was the wildlife rehabilitation group that was here last time we did the giveaway of the basket. And there are many, many other groups environmentally focused, and not if you're interested in something else that you can get involved with in the community. And there are small ways and large ways to do that. There are things you could do once a month, and there are things that you can do every day. So please don't let your busy schedule think that you can't help in some small way, because you can. And the best way to feel like you're making a difference is to narrow down exactly what it is that you're passionate about. The environment is a huge topic. Are you most concerned about clean water, or the landfill, or air quality, or wildlife rehab? Once you've found your niche, just focus it there, and that is enough. You don't have to tackle the whole environment. It's too much. The important thing is that we come together, and we do. As the song from the hymnal goes, as by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none. And now I will end this talk as we have ended many services before. Our service is over, and now our work begins.